My name is Lucy Duncan. I'm the Director of Friends Relations for the American Friends Service Committee. And welcome to this month's call for spirited action focused on faith-based immigrant justice. And Lori Kamala is already on the call. Hopefully Kuiper will be joining us shortly, and they'll be presenting about the current moment in the immigrant rights movement and about ways that people can support the movement. And we think they have a pretty great program planned. They're going to present for about the first 25 to 30 minutes, and then we'll have time for conversation and engagement with them for the next part. So why don't we start with just a brief moment of worship, and then we'll do some introductions. So let's have a moment of silence. Great, thank you. And I see some other people have joined. We're going to start by just going around really briefly. If everyone can share their name and their meeting, that will give us just an idea of who's on the call and to hear your voices. So why don't we, it looks like Piper's on. Great. So I'm Lucy Duncan. I'm transferring my membership to Green Street Meeting in Philadelphia yearly meeting. I'm the Director of Friends Relations. I'm really glad to see so many of you on the call. So who'd like to go next?
I'm Judy Goldberger. My membership is in New England yearly meeting and Beacon Hill Friends Meeting in Boston.
Hey, Judy.
My name is Jeff Levine. I don't have a meeting. I'm just here to learn.
Great. Wonderful. Welcome.
I should be next after Jeff. My name is Harold Salverta, and I, too, am here just to learn.
Great. Well, welcome. Glad you're here.
Donna Smith, Pacific Yearly Meeting, Redwood Forest Monthly.
Welcome.
Good to hear your voice, Donna. This is Anthony Manousis, Orange
Grove. Oh, hi, Anthony.
And also clerk of the Peace Committee for Pacific Yearly Meeting.
And great. This is Donna again. I'm clerk of Latin America Concerns Committee for Pacific.
Wonderful. Great to have you with us.
This is Marianne Michaels, and I'm also from Pacific PYM, Pacific Yearly Meeting, as well as Redwood Forest Meeting with Donna Smith. Hi, Anthony.
Great. Wonderful.
This is Patty.
Go ahead. Oh, go ahead.
Esther Delaplane, Bethesda Friends Meeting.
Welcome. Thanks for joining.
This is Val. I'm clerk of South Central Yearly Meeting, member of Friends Meeting of San Antonio, and coordinator of Peace Building in Las Americas of Friends Peace Teams.
Welcome. Hi, great to have you with us. Are there others? Go ahead.
Patty Hughes from North Carolina Yearly Meeting, FUM, and New Garden Friends Meeting in Greensboro.
Hey, Patty.
Hi.
And any others who haven't introduced themselves yet?
Holly Anderson from Ojai Worship Group, California.
Great. Okay, great. Do we miss anybody? Great. Thank you so much for joining the call. It's great to hear your voices and see the geographic diversity of all of you, and really appreciate it. So I know you're here to listen to Piper and to Lori. So Jen, Piper is the interfaith organizer for immigrant rights in Denver. I probably don't have her title quite right. And I've gotten to work with Piper a lot over the last couple of years, and she's bringing forward a powerful organizing model that she discovered through the Unitarians that I think is really great tool for Quakers. And she's a wonderful presenter and really very aware of the need to companion the immigrant community in a really powerful way. Lori is the... I'm not sure I know your your title, Lori, but an immigrant rights organizer in our Greensboro office, and she's going to tell a number of stories about that work. She's a Quaker, and she also will be co-leading a workshop at the FGC gathering this summer on immigrant justice with two of our other staff, and they're both amazing people with incredible work that they've been doing, and I'm excited that they're on the call. So we're going to, I'm going to pass it over to Ann Piper, who's going to begin, and she's going to talk about this moment in the immigrant rights movement, and then she's going to pass it to Lori, and the two of them will pass it back and forth and give you do the presentation and give you some information, and then when they're finished with their part, then we'll have the rest of the call time to have dialogue and questions and find out some more and also learn about the resources that you all are on the call. So, and I do want to say that this call is being recorded so that others can benefit from the information after this call is over. All right, so Piper, go ahead.
Thanks, Lucy. Thank you all for being on the call tonight. It's really encouraging to hear so many people get on, and especially for the subject that both Lori and I care so much about. So I'll just do a very brief history leading up to this moment, and I think that's really important, particularly for people who are newer to the immigrant rights movement, to have a context for, because oftentimes when I'm new to something, I don't understand the urgency that people who are directly impacted feel, because I'm coming in all fresh-faced. So the last 30 years in the immigrant rights movement, from the perspective of laws that have been passed, have, at the federal level, have all been restrictive. So over the last 30 years, we, even though it's, I'm kind of starting with the 1986 reform, which a lot of people think as an opening of the door, that's actually also the moment we criminalized work for undocumented immigrants in this country. And I think some people on the call remember you didn't used to have to fill out an I-9 to work. And the I-9 really represents this, the way that we made it more difficult for people to be equal in the workplace and to be their true self, and that they can't be working under their, if you're undocumented, it's there are a lot of ways in which we've criminalized you working in the country. And ever since then, we continue to see this ever-restrictive policy, and a lot of that has been coupled with militarization. So along the border, we see the border fence starting to go up in the 90s. That continues to the present with more fence going up. About half the southern border is fenced. They're talking about doing similar measures on our northern border now. And I know a lot of communities in the Pacific Northwest are starting to see the impacts of increased Border Patrol agents there. And the authority of those agents is to within 100 miles of our borders. So that goes pretty deep into border communities and coastal communities, where checkpoints can happen, where people are often stopped just to check their papers, literally. And then we see a lot of military equipment from Afghanistan and Iraq being used along the border, or recycled in our border militarization, and a lot of similar tactics. And the pieces of the border that are open are the most deadly parts of the desert, and we see a huge human toll there. We also have seen the enlistment and partnering through a variety of programs of immigration and customs enforcement with local law enforcement offices like the police and the sheriffs. So a very small offense such as driving without a license, if an officer arrests you for that, can lead to you being in deportation proceedings and being deported. And also at the same time, we see the judge's level of discretion being taken away and narrowed. So the bar for them is extreme and unusual hardship to citizen family members, which is not just the hardship and suffering, which I consider extreme, of being separated from your family, but would be like an illness or a serious illness of a citizen family member that can't be treated in a country of origin. So the bar is really high for judges. In the context of this, in the last 10 years, we've really seen the immigrant community start to claim their place here, their right to remain, and their place within the U.S. as home. We've seen people, the youth have really led a movement of coming out as undocumented, as saying to people, you might think I have papers because I speak English or because I have a job or I'm married to a U.S. citizen, but I'm actually not documented. And really taking the risk to come out and say that to people in a parallel to the LGBT movement in some ways, and then there are obviously some distinctions as well. So the youth have really started leading this movement and taking really creative actions. And one of the things that we were lucky to be a part of in Denver, there was a group called the National Immigrant Youth Alliance that's run by undocumented immigrants who decided to walk across the country in something called the Campaign for the American Dream during the 2008 presidential cycle. And they walked from California all the way to D.C., and one of their stops was in Denver, and they had done a lot of analysis on their walk. They had a lot of time to think about the political context and recognized that the president needed the Latino vote to win, and that this was a key moment to push him to fulfill some of the promises he made. And they went on, two of them went on hunger strike inside his campaign office in Denver for almost a week. And that's where President Obama's first executive action came, and that one was for youth, which provides them with temporary status. They can't ever get on their path to citizenship. But I was really inspired by that one because it was mostly communities of faith who came and supported the other walkers who were outside the office with food and blankets. It was actually unusually cold at night that summer in Denver, and because a lot of nonprofits weren't sure if this was the right tactic, and they weren't they were scared about coming out in support of what the youth were doing. There were lots of other organizations pushing the president to take to use his executive action at that time, but our feeling is that that would not have happened as soon as it did without that very strategic move. And after day two, then youth in other cities around the country also started sitting in to campaign offices. So by the end, by the time he made the announcement, there were, I think, six cities where youth were sitting in his campaign offices and shutting them down. And that has continued to be the truth for the movement. The first sort of civil disobedience actions by undocumented people were taken by the youth movement. Many of the outspoken adult leaders from the immigrant community will credit the youth and the movement for their vision and their ability to spot sort of strategic moments. And so what we see is parents starting to follow the leadership of youth in pushing back on this enforcement. And then we also see, and I'll just close with this, we also see around the country, states starting to make their own rules about immigration and in some ways really expensive policy by allowing youth who resided in the state to access in-state tuition, to access driver's licenses. More and more states are recognizing the contributions and the long roots of immigrants in their community. So we're kind of at this moment of extreme repression from the federal policy and at the same time a pushback from the immigrant community and support from some states and being more welcoming and being more inclusive. So with that, I'll pass it to Lori.
Great. Thank you so much, Piper and Lucy. And I'm glad to hear Patty on the call from North Carolina. Unfortunately, Piper, that was such a great introduction to this movement and this moment. And unfortunately, those states that are being more supportive and expanding access for immigrants, North Carolina is not one of them. So we definitely have our work cut out for us here, like in many other states as well. I'm going to share a little bit about what's going on with a couple of the different projects that we have going on right now in North Carolina, and share a couple stories about that. So in our North Carolina Immigrant Rights Program, we work with multiple constituencies. We work with immigrant communities of many different nationalities and immigration statuses, and we also work with Quakers and other people of faith. And we work on a lot of the different issues that Piper mentioned, and we have lots of different campaigns going on, and we also respond to a lot of the latest things that are happening. So we have been doing some community forums on executive action, which was the action that President Obama took in November, which expanded the deferred action for childhood arrivals and also created a deferred action program for the parents of U.S. citizens and legal permanent residents. You all may have been following this in the news, how there was a judge in Texas has halted this program temporarily, and the administration has appealed it, and we're all expecting it to the program to continue, but right now it's halted temporarily. And so last week I was doing a workshop on the new deferred action program and what this injunction means for everyone. This was a group of mostly undocumented moms. And so I started out with an icebreaker that I just intended to be lighthearted. I asked, you know, if you were a superhero, what powers would you want? So usually when we do this icebreaker, we get responses like, oh, I wish I could be invisible, or I wish I could read other people's thoughts, or I wish I could fly, stuff like that. But this time, most of the answers were really different from that, and they went something like this. Some people said, I wish I could snap my fingers and be with my kids in Mexico. I haven't seen them in so many years. Someone else said, I wish I had the power of freedom and never to be scared to go out of my house. So these, to me, just captured so tragically the situation of so many undocumented folks in our communities, and it's just a reminder of why we have to continue to do this work in partnership with immigrants who are organizing. I wanted to share one of the most rewarding aspects of my work is our digital storytelling program. And if I could just mention, I hear some background noise. I don't know if anyone has not muted their phone. Maybe now would be a good time to mute. And then when we get to questions, folks can unmute. But, okay. So, yeah, I wanted to share a little bit about our digital storytelling program. So this is a program in which we work with immigrants, refugees, young people, and really anyone else who's interested, but to tell their own stories in their own words. One of the things that I definitely noticed, and I think we all are probably cognizant of, is that way too often, even aside from what you hear on the media about immigrants or pastors say about immigrants, we as immigrant advocates who may or may not be immigrants, we often have the microphone. We often end up dictating what stories are important, and we end up telling those stories. And one of the reasons why I love our digital storytelling program is because it's part of handing a microphone, a pen, and a camera to folks who don't get told very often, to the folks who are the most directly impacted. And to me, this is one of the ways that we start to change that narrative about what's said, how the story of immigration is told in our communities. A lot of times in these digital storytelling workshops, we hear people who don't think that their stories are important. But through listening to each other and building this community and sharing, everyone has their experiences validated, and they're really able to share those experiences. We do storytelling programs in a lot of different ways, but my favorite way is through our group workshops. So folks are trained in effective ways to tell their stories, and they spend time journaling and giving feedback to each other in story circles. They take pictures to illustrate their narrative. They learn how to do basic audio editing and video editing, and they put it all together to create a 2 to 4 minute video. We always hold a community screening. Friends and families, as well as members of the public, get a chance to see these short films. And when there's issues that are raised in folks' stories that really relate to campaigns that we're working on, we try to get those stories into the hands of policymakers. So, for example, we did a really great event with a community group that was focusing on telling their stories about what it's like to live without having a driver's license and how hard it is and how much they're risking every time they drive. And we were able to hold a big community forum and actually invite the state legislators from that area to come and view the stories and meet these folks in the community for the first time and get to hear directly from them what their priorities were. And about a week, we're going to be starting our second Human Rights Through Digital Storytelling Camp for high school students during our spring break here. And through this program, students learn about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and they examine how human rights are being uplifted or violated in their own communities, and then they make a short video about that. Since we're on a call, I can't obviously show you guys any of our videos, but they are all online. If you go to our YouTube site, which is youtube.com/AFSCNC. But I wanted to share one quote that came from a film from a young person who made this video last summer. So here's what she said. "I knew my mother was undocumented, yet it didn't hit me until the incident. A police pulled her over, not because she was speeding or her lights were out, but because she looked Hispanic. From that point on, whenever she was late getting home, I feared she wasn't coming back, because unlike another child who assumes his mom stopped to get groceries or gas, I assumed she had been arrested and, like thousands of others, to be deported. Freedom of movement is a human right that shouldn't be taken away because you don't have the means to get a $15 plastic card." And I love to share Wendy's story because she had this really powerful story inside her, but she didn't think of it as important or worthy of sharing or as connected to this big, broader movement. And when she signed up for our camp last summer about making videos, she wanted to make a video about puppies. But through learning about human rights and the importance of standing up for her rights, you know, she came around to really wanting to highlight her mom's story, and she's kind of becoming a real leader in this movement. So that's what I wanted to share for now, and I want to toss it back to Piper to share a little bit more about working with the faith community.
Thanks, Lori. I think the digital storytelling that Lori just talked about and the importance of immigrant voice is a great segue into the model that we've been trying to use in the Denver office for about 10 years now, which is a model of allyship and accompaniment. We actually mostly organize citizens in support of immigrants and immigrant rights in our office. And out of the allyship work grew the faith work, and out of that faith work grew more of an accompaniment philosophy. And the idea behind accompaniment is really walking with or behind the immigrant community as they find voice and express and identify the priorities. And I think it's so tempting when we care about an issue that's not one where we're as directly impacted to just start doing policy work in a vacuum and to do the things that are most comfortable for us. But I think one of the values of working in a community and is and the benefits of taking the time to enter in the community and accompaniment with folks from the immigrant community is you do get a whole different perspective on what's important and what's a priority. And I'll just share one quick example. The first immigrant rights conference I went to, I went on behalf of another nonprofit who was really concerned about the potential fees that were being proposed for a citizenship path to citizenship at that time. And when I got to the conference, most of the people there were immigrants, and they said, "I don't care what the fee is. I'm worried about the English requirement because that's an easy way for an official or a system to exclude a big amount of people, because what does fluent mean?" And who will decide that, and how will it be tested? And because most of the immigrants that I knew were, to some extent, bilingual, my organization was not as concerned about that, and it was like a big light shining for us on maybe shifting our resources and our focus when we were meeting with legislators, you know, still mentioning the fines, but being more focused on the problems with English requirement and how that would be implemented. So accompaniment also really calls on us to do the work of looking at how we benefit from the immigration system the way it is as citizens, and I think that can help us identify better and more effective ways of changing the system so that there's more equality between all the members living in our community. And I think the other benefit of the accompaniment model is that it really calls on us to bring our full self to the work. And I think oftentimes as faith, people of faith, we end up being a person of faith in isolation working on a social justice issue, and the faith identity and our values can sometimes fall to the to be an afterthought. And the work that we've been trying to do is to really mentor and encourage people of faith within meetings or within other faith communities to do the work from their faith community and to organize other folks in their faith community to do that work, and to use a model that really brings in spiritual reflection as well as actual moving your feet and being in community and on the ground. So there's an opportunity for everyone in the faith community, people who are maybe a little bit more internally focused or more spiritually focused, to bring that to the table, and people who are more doers to bring that to the table, and then everyone is being a more complete self working on the campaign. And I think one of the most recent stories that illustrates the difference is when we've led or been, AFSC has been in partnership with immigrant rights marches in the past and brought the faith community to those marches. A lot of people from the faith community are not super into the chanting and the sign carrying, and the, you know, it feels maybe a little not so rooted or maybe confrontational to them. This last week we had a march for a person named Arturo Hernandez Garcia, who's been living in sanctuary in Denver for the last 5 months. And part of my work is helping to coordinate that sanctuary coalition. And we started with an interfaith service before the march. We had some prayer, we had reflection. Actually, David Poundstone from the Mountain View Friends Meeting led one of the worship pieces. And then we practiced song and chanting together as an expression of our prayer. So we were going to take our prayer into the streets through these chants and these songs. And there were about 350 people, and we did a debrief session, and so many people went back to that faith centering and grounding as both immigrant and citizen, as what made the march so powerful and so unified. And so I think we can bring a lot of, when we bring our faith values and our connection to how we build community and honor each other's human dignity to the work, we can actually, that's a skill or a kind of stepping back that sometimes it's hard to have as a secular organizer who's trying to meet, you know, the requirements of grants and the requests of the immigrant community. There's a lot of pressures there, and sometimes there's not a space to take a breath. And I think some of what the faith community can bring to any movement, and then in this instance the immigrant rights movement, is the opportunity to take a breath and to be cared for and to care for one another. And then what the immigrant community brings to us is a real prophetic understanding of how broken and damaging, that's not really broken, but how damaging the immigrant system really is in our communities. And what bring that question to us so we can struggle with it and figure out what that means for us as people of faith. How do we hear the call to respond to that? And then work in partnership with people who are directly impacted to be the most effective that we can be in accompanying them. And I know Lori actually has a lot more experience than I do working in Quaker meetings and organizing in that way. So I'm going to pass it back to her.
Thanks, Piper. I may be a lifelong Quaker, but I think you have definitely more than your share of experience organizing with the Quaker community. So really in awe of a lot of the amazing work that there, Piper and her colleagues are doing there in Denver. I'm going to share about another local project we're working on and how we're connecting that with Quakers. So one of our key state legislative, or well, really our key state legislative campaign this legislative session is tuition equality. A lot of you, it varies by the state, but many of you probably know that, and Piper referenced it too, in many places undocumented students must pay out-of-state tuition, even though they've been living in the community for years and years, and that out-of-state tuition can be up to four times as much as in-state tuition, again, even if they're meeting all the same academic and residency requirements that other students meet. So this has been a major organizing point for undocumented young people all over the country and certainly in North Carolina as well. It's an issue that affects thousands of students in our state, including many student interns through our office. Our office is very close to Guilford College, which is a Quaker school, and we get a lot of Guilford student interns as well as from other local campuses. And we have had a lot of undocumented students working in our office and who have really struggled with this issue. So we've really seen it very closely. I remember one student, her father, who was still in Mexico, her father was actually sending her money to pay for school because she couldn't afford tuition here. Even though she and her mom had lived and paid taxes in North Carolina since she was in middle school. In fact, with that particular student, we worked with the local Friends meeting to raise money to help pay the final amount of her tuition so that the same student could graduate. And now she is a paid organizer of Farm Worker Youth, which is really great. And we have a student in our office right now who doesn't, his work permit expired, which left him undocumented again, and so he has no idea how he's going to pay his tuition. So this is a real issue we're hearing about from young immigrant students all across the state and even right in our office. We're part of a statewide coalition that's been working on this issue for many years, and just a couple weeks ago we launched a local chapter of this statewide coalition, and it was really incredible. It was really about creating the space for this to happen in Greensboro where it hadn't existed before. So there was about 30 people at the inaugural meeting, which is a whole lot for Greensboro. And most of these were undocumented students as well as some parents and some advocates as well. And just to indicate the interest that came out of that, about one-third of the students who came to the meeting, so like 8 or 10 people actually signed up to be on the steering committee and they want to meet often, and they're just so ready to organize. So I'm really pleased that we were able to help create the space where young people could get together and plan their own stuff. One of the students actually brought up the issue of tuition equality at the Greensboro College Commission, which he serves on, just yesterday or Tuesday, and that group voted unanimously to support it, so they're already taking action. The students are working on developing their narratives. They're practicing speaking to lawmakers, and they're planning to join our lobby day in May, so they're really getting active. So knowing that this is a major issue for undocumented students and that this is an issue that students are taking leadership on and are really pursuing, we highlight that issue and we work with our ally groups and our Quaker communities. So I just presented last week at Piedmont Friends Fellowship and now Piedmont Friends Yearly Meeting, and I highlighted this issue of tuition equality and shared digital stories that undocumented students have created. And then I talked to Quaker youth about, you know, how they might support these efforts, sort of leading them through a mini lobby training today and talking with them about what they can do to help change the law. And we got a lot of great feedback from that session and a lot of interest in taking this issue back to their meetings. So, I think that I see our role being in relationship with immigrant groups and immigrant-led groups, and also in relationship with Quaker meetings and other people of faith, that we've been able to sort of serve as a liaison between these groups and to help foster relationships between those groups as well. We do help to coordinate two different ally groups, the Immigrant Solidarity Committee, which is housed at Charlotte Friends Meeting, and then in Greensboro we work with the Immigrant Rights Working Group, which several Quakers attend, but it's not officially connected to a meeting. So I feel like some of the roles that we've been able to play have been creating a space where it hasn't existed before for immigrants and particular immigrant youth to come together in our area and let them decide how they want to proceed with an issue, and then also kind of serving as this liaison. And of course, it looks different in every place. I mean, the Denver organizing model is so incredible, the stuff that they've been able to do and their deep, deep work that they've been able to do. And, you know, every place it looks a little bit different. But I think, as Piper indicated, I think the real important part is to have real deep relationships with the immigrant community so that as allies we're not kind of going off and just doing what we think is best, but being in relationship and knowing how to act in a way that is consistent with what our immigrant brothers and sisters are seeking. So with that, I think I'll turn it back over and see if Piper has any final thoughts before we open it up to questions.
Hey, Fawn. Sounds like you're all.
Oh, Piper, are you still on the call?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
I think I'm just so grateful that you all are on the call, and I do really feel like this is a key moment. I've been doing this work for about 10 years now, and I feel like so much of the pushing back on people we see right now is because the immigrant community and its allies have been making so much progress, and I think every extra person and voice who comes to the table right now makes a big difference in a way that or has a big impact in the way that maybe it didn't as much that many years ago. And then I think the other piece that I will share is part of the reason that my position was created is because the immigrant community was asking in Colorado so consistently, where is the faith community? Don't they believe that our struggle is a moral struggle? And so that when AFSC did an assessment of what to do with a new position in Denver, that was the response that they got from the immigrant community. And I think a lot of that is because immigrants really do attend and identify as people of faith at a higher rate than citizens do. And I think particularly people of faith coming with that identity to the immigrant rights movement has a big impact on the morale of the people who are involved. So thank you all so much, and I'll pass it to Lori to see if she has any final thoughts to add.
Thanks, Piper. I don't really have anything different to add. I echo Piper's gratitude that you guys are on the call, and I think we're always looking for ways to continue to connect with Quaker communities and other communities of faith to broaden and strengthen this really important moment. And I think Piper said something at the beginning about sometimes when we're new to this work or a little bit on the outside of this work, we don't always understand how urgent it is. But to the folks in the immigrant community, especially undocumented immigrant community, this is really urgent. You know, I mean, even now we're hearing that, you know, enforcement actions have been stepped up dramatically. We're hearing people are getting picked up. There are new raids happening all the time. So this is real, and families continue to be separated. And it's really, really critical. It's a very critical issue. And I think, yeah, we don't always recognize the urgency, but being hopefully hearing a little bit more and providing maybe some more opportunities to connect, we can, again, broaden and strengthen this movement so we can make some change.
Thank you both. So we're going to open it up for questions or comments from you all now. I mean, it's a lot of information and some really rich information. And so anyone who has a thought they'd like to add or a question, feel free.
This is Val Live Oak. In San Antonio, we're working with a collective of other churches to deal with a more recent problem than the folks who have been here a long time and are seeking immigrant rights, but I think it is pertinent. If it isn't, tell me. And that is that the current situation of young children and women and families that are attempting to get with status, or may not know, even people with really good cases for refugee status are, and even people who have been accepted as refugees, if families like mothers and children, they may continue to be held in currently increasing in size federal prisons or county prisons in South Texas under very large bail judgments. And by very large, I mean 8,000 or 9,000, whereas individual single women or single men even who are affected with those kind of situations for status, no mail, no bail. And I believe the reason is to attempt to discourage people from making the trip. But these are people who have arrived across the border and then surrendered and quite inhumanely and are now being held in these prisons that are all for private corporation prisons. I'm just wondering what y'all's groups are doing and if you have any help our meeting, which is officially working with that.
I don't know if other folks, I want to see first if other folks on, this is Piper, if other folks on the call are also working on that, and then I can share a little bit about what our San Diego office is doing, which I think is the most active office.
This is Lynette Arnold from Santa Barbara. I called in late, so I didn't get a chance to introduce the beginning, but I've been working with a group of folks from Pacific Yearly Meeting out here in California since, I think, June or July. We can kind of convene at our annual session, and sort of the main concern of our committee has been these undocumented young folks, unaccompanied minors, and then, yeah, this issue of family detention has been something that has really caught our attention and that we've been trying to do some work and organizing around. And I can talk a little bit more specifically about what we've been doing, if that now's the time. Or
yeah, I would. This is Lori. I would say, yeah. Do you want to share what you've been
sure.
doing, or if anyone else
yeah.
is working on family detention issues or private prison issues, you could maybe share after you give us a couple more details.
Sure. So we've been working. Basically, we're friends from different monthly meetings. We met at our annual session in July, and we've been doing conference calls every week or every other week since then, putting together minutes and sort of doing sort of work with our local meetings and then coordinating with one another kind of at this sort of state level about our efforts. And so specifically on the issue of family detention, one of the things that we're recently getting involved with is a pen pal effort to write to women and children who are detained. And we're in touch with some folks, I think mostly Lutherans, who are doing visitation from San Antonio. So Val, you might know these folks. They're doing visitation at Carnes and Dilley, which are the two big family detention facilities in Texas. And so coordinating with them to get this pen pal program started. And then I think some of us participated also in a National Day of Action that happened on the 24th, calling for an end to family detention in honor of Oscar Romero's anniversary, an event that was sort of led by Central American immigrant communities and that we supported.
Thank you for sharing that. Piper, did you want to share a little bit more about what's going on in San Diego? Piper, are you there?
Piper, are you still there? We can, if others have something they want to share, she may be taking care of her child right now. So
this is Anthony Menousis. I just wanted to say that as clerk of the Peace Committee, I've been following what Lynette Arnold and others have been doing, and we are hoping to have a minute brought to the yearly meeting, but also all those other activities are very promising. Here in Pasadena, the Unitarian Church has reached out to the Adelanto Detention Center. And it started with a pen pal program and then visitation, and it was followed by Judy Chu, our local representative, going to Adelanto. And she has sponsored a bill that would help to make sure that the children crossing the border have legal assistance. So I think these programs can grow. I think it's really important that we connect with people who are in detention centers.
Yeah, and I will say that in across AFSC, across the country, there's different programs that are working to different degrees directly in detention centers. We have three offices across the country in Iowa, in Newark, and in Miami that do legal services and do legal work with folks who are detained. I did want to mention also regarding the unaccompanied refugee children that one of the provisions that a lot of people aren't aware of President Obama's executive action in November is that he also established new priorities for deportation. Some of them are what we might expect, threat to national security or whatever. But another one of the top priorities for deportation is anyone who has entered the country recently. So this means that all of the unaccompanied refugee children are basically on a fast track to deportation, and that is just an issue. We're certainly dealing with legal service needs here in North Carolina for those children. But one of the things I've observed is that there's a lot of interest from church communities, from Quaker communities, and unaccompanied refugee children, yet it's I think sometimes we've really been trying to connect these issues and use this kind of as an opening for people who are interested in the children's issues to also to continue to be interested in other issues of immigrant rights. I think sometimes there's maybe a lot of interest in that particular issue and not as much as some of the other ongoing issues, particularly related to deportation detention. So I don't, for the individual in San Antonio, I'm sure I didn't help you at all in your question, but we may be able to connect you to some other folks who are working on those issues.
Well, that's great. Who was the person in California besides Anthony who spoke?
Donna Smith. And Lynette Arnold. This is Donna
Smith,
and I wanted to mention that I live in Sonoma County. And when the child refugee issue was so much in the news, North Bay Organizing Committee, and Redwood Forest is a member of that, got together with the county agencies here, and the Protective Service Agency actually offered to house these children in our shelter. Of course, nothing was happening with transferring to that sort of thing, I think mainly because it's privatized mostly. But I thought that was an incredible response from county government here. And
wow.
Also county government has offered to do pro bono work for unaccompanied minors. And there is, she was a minor when she came across the border. She now is 18. but we've been involved with accompanying her to get her fingerprints, accompanying her to court, and she's going to be speaking, and her mother too. She's now with her mother at our meeting for worship, well, after meeting for worship, and we're going to try and find out, you know, if there's any way that we can be helpful with referrals or whatever is needed.
That's
great. I think it's been quite an incredible model here that our county government has stepped forward with.
That's fantastic.
And obviously there's paper, I think, is needed to step away to take care of her child, but I think there's also the information about what we're doing on the border and Pedro Rios's work. He's also going to be with Lori and with Jaja Wang at the FTC gathering, and they'll be co-leading a 5-day workshop on immigrant justice that you would all be welcome to participate in. The gathering's going to be in North Carolina this year, outside of Asheville, so
I'll be there.
Great. Do you want to say anything more about Pedro's work, Lori?
I mean, Pedro Rios, who is our AFSC staff, one of our AFSC staff members in San Diego, is just, you know, extraordinary and doing really incredible work. And he's, I believe he's from San Diego, and so he's really been able to see the way that the border has changed and the way how the militarization has impacted life there. And their office, the AFSC office, is one where people really come to for help and assistance. There have been people who have come to their office who have been, whose family members have been killed by Border Patrol, and our AFSC office has been able to work with those individuals and help, you know, in investigations on the Border Patrol. And they've really done some remarkable work and are real leaders in the country, in particular on the border issues. So I'm not sure what else to say about that, Lucy. I think any workshop with Pedro will be amazing, regardless of my participation. Pedro will be there.
Are there any other questions or comments?
I would like to make a comment. My name is Lori Dotson. I live in Montgomery County, Maryland, and I'm an ESOL teacher. I work with elementary students. And I've gotten involved with a group of educators to work to advocate for Dreamers. And through TESOL, we actually did a 5-week free online course open to the public on what teachers can do to support Dreamers, since young kids often trust their teachers and come out to their teachers when they realize they have these obstacles to get into college. I was wondering what other people are doing to reach out to teachers to get them involved in helping students in the immigrant community.
Great question. That sounds like an amazing resource. I'd love to check it out. This is Lori here in North Carolina. And, we're certainly working with teachers in a lot of ways, and one of our coalitions that we work with that's education-focused certainly does a lot of work with teachers. But I think that did you say it's a webinar or a
No, we were a 5-week free course. We did it through Google Plus, so it was like live, it was weekly discussions, and we have a syllabus up through TESOL's Electronic Village Online, where you can still access all our materials we pulled together to try to help connect teachers.
That sounds great. I'd be interested in those materials.
If you send them to friends@afsc.org, we can put them somewhere that people can find.
That would be great.
An idea in addition to teachers, seems to me one of the things we often forget. My name is Harold Salvert. I was an organizer way, 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 way back along on many different issues. Sometimes it has great value for somebody who just comes along. I recall a youngster in front of a judge, and the judge was giving this young man a hard time, and he looked over at this old man who had come along just to stand next to him. And the judge said, "Who are you and what are you doing here?" And he said, "I'm Jose's friend and I just came to stand next to him." I think we often forget how valuable and powerful it is when some of the people who don't have all of the background that you've been talking about tonight, but care, and just come and stand next to and say, I'm here to be supportive.
Yeah, I went to a deportation hearing with, this is Lucy, with Piper, when a young woman who had a citizen child was facing deportation hearings, and there was a number of people from the faith community. There was a Unitarian minister and me, and she, I mean, it was kind of horrifying to be in the courtroom to see how perfunctory this ripping of people's lives apart is, and how you know, it's kind of, you know, looking at the banality of evil, but it was very important, I think, for her that we were there, and, you know, at the end we prayed with her, but we, you know, were there for her, and I think it did matter, and I think that's sort of the basis for the accompanying model that Piper was talking about.
Exactly.
Is really just being willing to be there for people and in the ways that they ask, I think is
mm-hmm.
huge, you know, it's a huge thing and really, really important.
Yep, I totally agree. And I think, Harold, I think that's a great example of the just standing beside someone that can make a huge impact. And you don't have to have all the information. You don't have to be an expert in these issues. You don't have to have worked on it forever. Sometimes it's just standing next to somebody, and that can have a really big impact.
This is Marianne Michaels from Redwood Forest Meeting in California. I actually was one of the people who did accompaniment, and my experience in the court, although I'm not in any way a legal person, was to be just overwhelmed by the number of people who are there alone, both children and parents with children, and people whose first language is clearly not English and who have no support, and the need is tremendous.
Yeah. That is. So we're coming up at the end of the time, and I want to echo what Piper and Lori said. I think Piper had to go and take care of her child, so she's not here at the end, but I really appreciate all of your comments and your interest, and this call will be posted, the recording of it will be posted at Calls for Spirited Action, and I did want to mention a couple of other resources. So the Calls for Spirited Action is one place that you can have a resource. The immigrant rights staff of AFSC has created a thing of a really amazing resource of five things that you can do to support immigrant justice, which includes many rich different ideas, and is really based on that accompaniment model. And then the organizing model that Piper was talking about, we're working with her and with some of the Unitarian ministers that helped to develop it, to develop a training for Quakers. And that whole model is available at afsc.org/friends/resources. It's very simple, very elegant, but very, very powerful, based on trying to create restorative justice and bring faith and action really intimately together. It's not that this is all new ideas, but it's a very powerful frame for doing that, and that's available, and we're going to be developing a training that and offering that to Quakers. And then obviously there's also this workshop that Lori and Pedro and Zsa Zsa are going to be doing at the gathering this summer, And the thing that most excites me most about these calls is hearing your voices and knowing how much work is being done by Quakers and hearing people connect with each other. I think that's really very, very powerful. If there's any last question before we call it and before we end, and Lori, thank you very, very much. And I want to appreciate Piper, who's not in the room anymore. But if there's a last thought or two, we have a minute for that.
This is Patty.
Okay.
Lori, I just wanted to say hi.
Mm-hmm.
And,
hi,
Patty. Thanks for all of your hard work, you and Piper, and this was very informative and helpful. Thank you.
Great. Wonderful. Thanks, well, again, yeah, thank you all. And if you have any questions or want to do any follow-up, you can email me at friends@afsc.org. I can connect you with other people. I can connect you with Lori and Piper, or with some more resources if you need them, and or with each other. So feel free to contact me. And I really appreciate all that you describe that you're doing, which I'm sure is not everything. And keep doing it. And thank you very much.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night. You're welcome.
Good night.